No, it's not a Star Wars making of documentary in honor of Free Solo. What's the most genuinely scary thing you've ever seen in a documentary?
I'm Katie Rich, and I only have a vague memory of the documentary Cropsey, but I do remember them visiting the mental institution around which the action takes place and where the real-life boogeyman emerged from, and it was scary. But I scare easily, so take that with a grain of salt.
I'm Matt Patches, and I am going to kind of cop out and go with Jimmy Chin, who directed Free Solo's last documentary, Meru, which was all about climbing a giant mountain, the Shark's Fin on Meru Peak in the Indian Himalayas, and failing, and then for some reason going back and trying again. It's incredible and terrifying.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I feel like this is also a cop-out, albeit a different kind, just because it's so obvious, but I'll go with, like, you know, pick a scene in The Act of Killing.
Well, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I mean, pretty lame, but also true.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 230, and it's the week of Wednesday, September 26th. And on that day, in 2018, this year, we were only 9 days away until the Star is Born soundtrack was released. I hear there's a movie attached to it, too. But who cares?
Irrelevant.
That, David?
Irrelevant.
Unneeded.
So we are down on David Gonzalez this week, which might be a bad sign for our reviews next week, because apparently we got a whole bunch of reviews when all four of us were finally on the show last week. So thank you, everybody, for rewarding our good behavior. David, are you going to pick three to read?
Yeah, I am. If you wrote one and I don't get to yours, we will get to it in the future. Happy to have a backlog. Please keep sending in your reviews. First is FoShizzleDrizzle420. Hey!
Hey. Smoking if you got him.
Yeah. Woo!
What is Kevin Smith? What is Kevin Smith's
what's he like in real life? I don't know. What's it's like Snoochie Boochies?
Snoochie Boochies.
Snoochie Boochies, indeed. anyway, this podcast is my ish, says FoShizzleDrizzle420. And I have to be perfectly honest, in my old age, if not for the 5-star rating, I would not know if ish were positive or negative. I feel like I think it's like I have an issue with this podcast. I don't know. Anyway,
wow,
he says, yo,
ancient.
Or she, I don't know. Or they, it's 2018. Yo, really love this podcast. It's pretty much the only thing I can stand listening to when I'm making my 2-hour daily commute. Whoa. I love pretty much everything about this show, including David Ehrlich, misspelled, even when he has to constantly reference the fact that he went to Columbia, also misspelled. Also untrue, I think. Anyway, he's pretty... I mean, I did go to Columbia, and then I dropped out of
you
Columbia.
You did that a lot more when you were actually going.
Did I? I don't know. I've never really thought of my education as a point of pride, especially since I then dropped out of the same school and always wished that I'd gone to NYU instead, even though they rejected me.
Hell,
this is all on the record.
Yeah.
He's pretty much Fighting in the War Room's equivalent of Andy Bernard. I don't know who that is, but I will look it up. Anywho...
Did you not watch The Office?
No, fuck The Office. I'm a man of taste. Anywho, just thought... I have like a deep... antipathy towards The Office. No, thank you. Anyway,
next week's segment.
Just Talking. Thought I'd mention I wanted to listen to old episodes on iTunes, but noticed you cut off pretty much the first 100 episodes. Is there any way you can put back up the entire archive on iTunes? I know it's probably a pain, but it would mean a whole lot to us folks who want to go back and listen to those apps without dealing with the website and relabeling all the MP3s. Hope you can make mine and everyone else's dream come true. P.S. More Joanna. Well, for Shizzle Drizzle 420, I'm sorry for my flippant tone.
This would have been a great week for Dave to actually be on the podcast.
Yeah, because he can answer.
He can answer those questions.
But I actually haven't answered this question.
Well, if you allow me just to say how much I appreciated for Shizzle Drizzle 420 listening to the show and wanting to hear the archives. But
now Patches is going to explain why.
Yes, the answer to this question has to do with the amount of space that we can like put in an RSS feed, and I think we kind of cap out at 100, so every time we get an episode, something falls off. But Dave keeps the archives on fightinginthewarroom.com, so you can click.
I think that's what he was saying,
and
is
listen
that
to
they're
MP3s.
Available there, but it's just kind of a pain to get to.
Well, yes, these are the struggles that you go for. What is fandom if not crossing the desert of the internet to find what you really love?
I think that our show is like, it's nice that it's worth wanting to listen to those episodes, but I think it's not good enough to actually pull up the website and go through the work. I think it's fine. That's
yeah. Like, have you listened to Serial season 3? Like, there's other stuff to listen.
Yeah, that's a good
better.
Enough review unto itself. So I'll say
have
that.
Have you listened
was
to
very
Serial season 3?
Okay, moving
Wait,
on.
What'd you say? I have listened to Serial. I have listened to two.
No, we're plugging our podcast here, not Sarah Koenig. She's
yeah,
got
they
enough.
They don't need us.
LTSBLB says, okay, I'll write a review. Oy Gewalt. 5 stars.
Is that Jordan Hoffman?
Yes. Stop the current podcast to write a review because you all are so upset there are no new ones. Finally subscribed True. And falling in love with both Dave and Katie on Storm Spoilers and Little Gold Men, respectively. Love the banter and dynamics of all the hosts. Glad to have it added to my weekly group of voices in my head. It's like Split. I like it. Also, I appreciate you all for
I
making me
not.
Sound smarter than I am about all... Sorry, it's like glass. We'll see. Okay. I don't know. Also, I appreciate you all for making me sound smarter than I am about all things pop culture. Much love and respect, Lindsay. Lindsay, I love that you signed this review with your actual name. What a rare treat that is for us. Definitely
Thanks,
helpful.
Lindsay.
It's not necessarily her name. She could be catfishing you.
We should make it so that you cannot proceed in a given episode unless you've stopped and written us a review. I don't think we have that technology, but appreciate it, Lindsay. And finally, for this week, Matt Passantino, full name. Wow, really one up in Lindsay there. Says, a fan of all. As a relatively new listener within the past year or so, this has become a favorite. I went back and binged most old episodes, because what else is one supposed to do at work? The chemistry is great, but I'll take a brief moment to stick up for David Ehrlich, hey, who's often bemoaned in these reviews. As someone who positions themselves as the snob of their cinema circles, I'm a fan. Great stuff to all, and thanks for the constant entertainment. Was this review helpful? Immensely. Yeah, I feel like the there's a whole subset of jobs where you can actually get away with listening to a podcast without interfering with your work, and that's what we make the show for.
That was my first job out of college, as I was like just updating a database. I listened to all of the This American Life episodes that were streaming on their website because
wow.
It was 2006 and podcast barely.
And you existed. Didn't like tune out and lose the thread and whatever Ira Sachs, I wish.
Ira Glass. Him.
Thank you. Glass.
We're doing so much Serial related promo in this episode for some reason. These reviews
Sponsored
are all great.
By.
Keep them coming. Thank you. And I really enjoyed people telling us how they listen to the show and like where they are and 2 hours and work. So keep that up.
Yeah, more life in these.
Life itself.
So last week, we're all catching up on Netflix. It was a deluge of Netflix content, and we, as if you listened to the last episode, didn't watch any of it. We watched Forever on Amazon, but we're catching up.
Take that, movies, streaming wars.
Yeah, we've picked our sides, but then I guess we've crossed the lines. We're the Benedict Arnolds of
Did you? Wait,
streaming.
This is a quick update. Did anybody finish Forever but me?
I finished it before our podcast. I was speaking with full spoilers.
That's right. I think. David, did you finish it?
No, I haven't watched any of it since we recorded.
I will say for Forever, it's like a little difficult. Like, if you're not slipping down that slope after episode 4, I could see people not getting to the end.
True, but you gotta do the Hong Chao Jason Mitchell episode. That's
true.
That's essential. Anyway.
But anyway, let's talk about something that you could watch just the last episode of and be satisfied.
Like, nothing. There is nothing.
This premise.
Yeah, I am sorry. I do not have it. In me, a hyper episodic show like procedural. I was able to watch the first couple episodes, and my wife watched the rest of the first season, and I caught up with her at season 2. But something like American Vandal to just jump into the final episode of season 2 is madness. It upsets everything that I believe in this world, the natural order of things. How dare you, sir?
Well, apologies for doing that. It wasn't my choice. I actually wasn't planning. I didn't watch American Vandal season 1. I watched one episode and kind of checked out. I just thought it was too goofy and I couldn't get into the plot. And I know people absolutely love it. Wasn't for me. And that's fine. And American Vandal season 2, did not care. Heard a lot of people in my office, especially, talking about how they thought it was a masterpiece. They thought it was hilarious, but also really poignant. Maybe even a little less funny than season one, and taking itself a little more seriously, trying to do something with its kind of mockumentary form.
I reject the premise that season one did not do something. Season one, okay. If you had stuck it out, is quite the commentary on our current age.
Okay. It has a lot to say. I didn't mean to undermine. But I let my wife watch American Vandal. Asterisk to this entire conversation, since we started with Forever, I have a correction of last week's episode. My wife and I do not fight over fork tines being up and down. My wife, Michelle, she took umbrage in me using the word fight. We have heated discussions where we think about these things.
Your first mistake is that fights. Your spouse listens to this podcast.
They're not fights. Probably. Anyway, so she watched all of American Vandal, and I just happened to catch the very last episode and found it totally engrossing and satisfying without needing to know many of the characters. It played like a movie. Who'd have thunk these television shows can have the, like, you know, a 10-minute intro on what the situation is, what the crime is, and where it's all going, and kind of tie it in a knot. This season is very much about social media preying on people and using their social lives on the internet against them, at least from where I was standing in the back half of the season. But Katie and David, having watched a lot of the from the very beginning, what do you
having
make of
watched
this?
It like an actual television show, like yeah. An insane human being.
No, knowing that it's a poignant ending, I'm kind of interested if each episode justifies its existence, because the very last one ties it all in a knot. It's very fulfilling.
Just to be clear before we start, I've only seen half of it, so we're not going to spoil what actually happens in the end.
Yes, that's why I'm being vague.
In general sense. But David, can you defend American Vandal as a television show?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it requires a defense. I think its qualities are rather self-evident. But I will say that
what's the episodic joy of?
Yeah, not to defend Patch's approach, which I disagree with on philosophical terms, but on to sort of find a rationale therein. Part of the parody that American Vandal season 2 is doing is of shows like The Jinx or Making a Murderer, shows where they withhold information deliberately so they can parcel it out in order to make the most engaging investigation, engaging mystery story possible, even if it sort of violates the natural narrative of things and how they gather clues and really pulls you along for longer than it might necessarily have to. I mean, there's no reason you couldn't unpack the mystery of American Vandal season 2 in a tight 90 minutes, as opposed to the 4 hours plus that it takes over the course of 8 episodes, which are roughly 30 minutes, but because it's Netflix, they can all vary from episode to episode. But you do get to spend a lot of time with the individual characters, all of whom tend to stick in your mind. They're all very well fleshed out. They all have their own social problems and conditions, their own fears and desires, their own masks that they wear on social media, the identities they curate for themselves, which are all central to what the show is doing. And so while it's not always driving in a engaging way to the solution of this mystery, it's telling that that season two, and this is not necessarily giving anything away, has an actual resolution to the mystery, whereas season one teases the idea of a concrete resolution before undoing it and leaving you with more questions than answers. But season two is very much hinges on a clear resolution and then a speechifying moral from one of the narrators who makes sure that nobody, even in the back of the class, misses what this season was all about.
My sense is that, again, only having seen half of season two, is that season one was much more about a specific character. You've got this kid, Dylan Maxwell, who is, like, just that character was just so wonderful.
And amazing.
Held together
amazing.
The first season.
Is that Jimmy Tetro's character?
Yeah.
Yes. Like, okay.
Yeah. And
one of the best performances in any medium of 2017.
It was so great.
All right. That is definitely the David take. Absolutely.
It's pretty good. The sense I get is that season two is not as much driven by, like, a specific character. Like, you've got a kid who's, like, the main suspect and who's been expelled for doing the crime, but it's painting a broader tapestry is the sense that I get. So it feels
smearing
like
a greater tapestry, if you will.
Smearing a greater tapestry across.
There's a lot of poop in this show.
A lot of poop. So the idea in season one is that, like, by telling you whether or not Dylan Maxwell did it, it kind of resolved itself, and who actually did the crime didn't really matter. But it seems like in season two, the identity of the turd burglar matters a little bit more.
The crime being what, Katie? In your words.
The brownout. Not there. That's their
word. To describe it. No, to what would
well,
the
it's
be?
Actually way more elaborate than you get a sense from the trailer. Someone taints the lemonade in the cafeteria so that people just uncontrollably shit themselves, and then puts poop in a pinata in an English classroom, and then also in a t-shirt cannon at a pep rally. It's really gross. Like,
and
impressively
that's
gross.
That's not all.
Ah, that's right. I think in the last episode I watched, there was a hint of a possible fourth crime. So I got to see what happens.
More poop.
I'm not telling. But yeah, I mean, I think it's also crucial that this season is set in a much more affluent school than season one. And they lean into that a little bit. They talk about the richest girl in school and her concerns. They talk about the star athlete who drives 45 minutes from a not so nice or not as nice area anyway. And
who is
sort
black,
of a different
unlike
socio.
Most of the kids at the school.
Yeah, I mean, there are other black kids at the school. It's not... the only one, but he definitely comes from a different socioeconomic environment than some of these kids. Although not all the white kids who are centered, especially not the main kid who you see in the first couple episodes, is especially affluent. Yeah, so the movie does in
the movie
in order to the movie fuck.
You get the patches
the Netflix
on
the content in while exploring social media and all those things does touch upon class or use class as a conduit to get under the surface of things.
I did want to say, like, I tweeted this last night, just watching this in the wake of reading all about Brett Kavanaugh's high school experience and then watching the episode, I think it's the third one, about the basketball player and kind of how he's allowed to get away with anything. And it's a different situation because he's, you know, like the black athlete. But the idea of, like, a private school rallying around someone who is privileged in some way and letting them get away with murder, it felt really relevant. And I don't
know
if that was what they meant to show
about
to me
that,
about.
But I think I actually... At that point, because I just binged like the last five episodes of the show, at that point, I was actually behind where you are now. And I watched season three with what you had tweeted in mind, or episode three. And I thought you were dead on. I mean, that's exactly what that episode is doing. Obviously, there are mitigating circumstances that it's not a one-to-one analog for Brett Kavanaugh. And how could it be? But, it is, that's absolutely one of the many things that's going on there.
Yeah.
And it's something that the show does not find an easy out for. I mean, this is a show where there may, you know, regardless of the identity of the turd burglar, everyone is a little bit guilty of something.
Patches, have we convinced you to watch the rest of it?
Well, see, so I was going to say that's the argument against just watching the last episode. I think, you know, my experience is kind of creeping into the show. There aren't a lot of characters, and they're pretty deep even in the last moments. The characters that you're talking about all get to reflect on the crimes and the fallout, and I actually thought the final episode was pretty poignant, and then as David described, they kind of just put a button on it and blurred out exactly what they're investigating or interrogating as far as, like, social media is concerned and our lives lived online.
Go on.
Well, what I was going to say is I'm missing that deeper character well, like the lead up to these moments, the real payoffs. One of the things that I thought was most intriguing, and yeah, who would have thought? No, but what I'm saying is the reason I might go back and watch it is because there's this trio of characters. They're in a band together, and one of them has been accused of the crime. And what ends up happening, I won't spoil, but the way that their relationship changes, I thought was really interesting. And the way teenage friendships form and crystallize and then morph as the heavy drama of high school, whether it's like an actual crime like depicted in American Vandal or just the drama you have between friends, I think the show's really onto something, and I would want to go back and watch that because I don't see relationships like that forged in television very often. But
yeah.
My big question to both of you is that the show, it does seem more serious than I remember the original season being. And in a good way, in a, like an evolutionary step forward. But they're still like making Dingleberry jokes. You know what I mean? Like they're still making poop puns in a way that I think is like...
It's one of the show's strokes of genius is that it speaks the language of high school kids. It engages with social media in the way that it's actually being used and not in a way that you would see it on like a network television show. And then what I really enjoyed about the season, which... and I thought the first season was weighty as well, even though it was much, much funnier. And I think they were wise not to just try to replicate that formula. They're trying to parody a different kind of documentary filmmaking here. But I like that in the very clear speech at the end of the movie, they are not necessarily condemning social media. They are using it as an outreach of people, or an outgrowth of people's natural tendencies to perform their identities and curate who they are and have a sort of double self, and seeing it as both a potentially good thing and a bad thing, and making sure that as long as the message is that as long as there are a few people, you know, who are important to you, who know who the real you is, as long as you know who the real you is, then the rest is okay. And I think that it finds a amenable and sustainable middle ground for the moral use and value of social media, because there are a lot of absolutes being tossed around in the last couple episodes of the show about whether or not it's a good or bad thing. And I think the conclusion it comes to is ham-fisted, as it is a good one. It's a smart show. Very smart about the way we live now. The way we live now in all capital letters.
That's right. About life itself, you might say.
About life itself. The ultimate unreliable narrator.
On Amazon.
All right.
So last week, I went with a bunch of film critics, there were like 10 of us, to go see A Simple Favor, because it was the one movie playing that none of us had seen. And
I don't think, did they invite critics to see it? I don't recall.
They did.
And
Kate Erbland, my coworker at IndieWire, went and saw and reviewed it for us. It was the night before. I think I was already at TIFF, or I was on my way there. It was right before TIFF. But this movie was really lost in the shuffle, at least as far as critics are concerned, because so many of us were at the Toronto International Film Festival.
They screened it here the night that I got home from TIFF, which was insulting, honestly.
Yeah. But it has, especially relative to its budget, been doing pretty well at the box office. At the time of this recording, it's up to $42 million worldwide on a budget of $20 million, and it was number two at the box office this weekend, so the number's only going to go up. It will turn a profit. But man, did we have fun watching this movie. I think expectations were not super high, and we were drinking, and then the Star is Born trailer came on, and we were like all cheering in the theater and singing along. It was a magical moment. Best film of the year, the Star is Born trailer, of course, not the actual The Star is Born. And then A Simple Favor began. And what a delightful, whip-smart, clever, utterly hilarious movie this is, featuring one of my very favorite performances of the year from none other than Blake Lively.
What is this movie about? And
I'm
who
happy
made
to
it?
Tell you, Pat Patches. So this movie is sort of a parody of Gone Girl for the mommy blogger set, but there's enough integrity to its story and enough interest and real pathos to the characters where it's not like a Leslie Nielsen movie. I mean, you can actually, you do sort of get involved in these characters as people and want to follow all the twists and turns which go in
crazy and crazy. Blake Lively in a like Leslie Nielsen movie. Now that you mention it, I said I'd kill for Blake Lively in a Leslie Nielsen movie.
I think there's not going to be another Leslie Nielsen movie anytime soon, unless you want to like edit her into an American Carol. Woof. Anyway, not my American Carol, if you know what I'm talking about. But so the story, which is from a screenplay by Jessica Sharzer, and was directed by Paul Feig, who is a name that probably a lot of you know. He directed Bridesmaids and the god-awful Ghostbusters film. And
Ghostbusters film is good.
Oh, it's terrible.
You were one of those, David.
I'm one of those.
We only had the last 100 episodes of this podcast up, we could go back and listen to our review.
I actually think this is Paul Feig's funniest movie. I thought that Bridesmaids was like only sporadically funny. I think The Heat was funny for its vulgarity. But doesn't really hold. I really hated the Ghostbusters remake.
How dare you talk about Spy this way?
Oh, Spy is really good. I do really like Spy. Rose Byrne. What can you do? This movie could have used Rose Byrne. Every movie could use Rose Byrne. It doesn't have her. But it's very, very, very funny. It's about a mommy blogger named Stephanie Smothers, played by Anna Kendrick, who she's one of the other mothers at the school where her son goes in Connecticut, in a Greenwich-like neighborhood, is a high-powered fashion PR director played by Blake Lively, who is... What a character this is. I mean, she her motto is like, you have to charge forward and fuck them in the face. She's like, which out of context doesn't really make any sense, but she's a real bulldozer of a human being. She has no social tact whatsoever, is not a particularly good mother. But it, like, every word that comes out of her mouth, there's a whole dialogue scene between the two of them, like their first hangout, really. And they're such mismatched characters because Anna Kendrick's character is so prim and proper, as you might expect.
Wasn't Blake Lively actually a mommy blogger? Or
Happy to talk to you about this.
Preserve.
So she started something called Preserve, which was described by Vanity Fair.
This is a 5-minute segment.
Yeah, okay. Wait, is this part of your grand thesis on Blake Lively?
Go on IndieWire.com. You can read my whole thing about how Blake Lively is now one of America's great actresses, even though she has
a weird fetish. And Preserve factors in?
Yes, absolutely, because she has a weird fetish for the antebellum American South, which is very fucked up.
She got married on a plantation in South Carolina.
Yeah, but does not necessarily affect the quality of her performances, all of which, all of the good ones anyway, have been in the wake of the death of Preserve. It seems like she realized that she needed to take risks in her acting and put her heart into things, and all the movies that she's made since have been really interesting, and this is one of them. But to wrap up A Simple Favor, her character disappears. After asking the simple favor of having Anna Kendrick look after her son for the afternoon. And then Anna Kendrick starts hanging out a lot with Blake Lively's, now sort of abandoned husband, who's played by Henry Golding of Crazy Rich Asians fame.
Hunk of the moment.
Hunk of the mo. And then shit gets crazy from there. Eventually Blake Lively is in a cemetery wearing a incredible men's suit, one of many she wears in the movie, with nothing underneath it other than the jacket and the pants, and holding pimp cane. It's a cane with a bejeweled skull on the top of it.
Don't say pimp cane.
That sounds accurate.
I've been watching a lot of The Deuce, so I don't know. That's what came to mind. But
Blake Lively would be a pimp on The Deuce.
This sounds like Death Becomes Her or something.
It is not like Death Becomes Her. It definitely cleaves a lot closer to Gone Girl.
In tone,
but it goes off the rails a little bit in a way that I did not enjoy. But it's just so funny. Like, there's so many funny parts. The tone is really difficult to maintain, but all the cast, Blake Lively in particular, follow-ups Paul Feig's lead of being able to thread the needle between the parody and the more serious aspects. There are a little bit like a socially regressive elements about it, how it upholds something that Sonia Soraya was saying on Twitter today, which I agree with, how the movie sort of does uphold the traditional good mom, bad mom rubric. But it's such a romp. It's so much fun. See it with a drink in your system and as many good friends as you can find. You will laugh
David
hilariously.
Movie Ehrlich says, yeah, see it.
See it. And I really do believe that if the Academy had any taste for subversion and wasn't just looking at the, you know, whatever Fox Searchlight drops out, set in like a period mode. I don't know. I love Fox Searchlight. Their latest crop of movies, real good. But if the Academy had any taste for this sort of stuff, beyond the obvious, Blake Lively would be nominated for Best Supporting Actress and she would deserve it.
Well, keep stumping and make the change you want to see in this industry. And try and get her a retroactive Oscar for Green Lantern. She's good.
I'm on it.
No, oh, Jesus Christ.
Zendaya is Michi. And LeBron James is Gwangi. Danny DeVito is Dargo. Ooh, Colin is Stone King. And Zendaya is Michi.
Hey, Patches.
What?
I just wanted to get another look at you.
Patches, are you
smiling? Is that from a movie or something? I actually do know that that's from a movie, but not because I've seen the trailer enough times, but because everyone that I follow on the tweets and on the Facebooks are sharing A Star Is Born memes. This is a movie that no one has seen in the real world, but all the people, and I'm not just blaming like our journalist friends. I think these memes are widespread.
As far as I know, Bobby Finger has not seen it, and he is the
It would not matter
A Star Is Born memes
if this movie had actually screened.
All hail Bobby Finger of Jezebel for being the greatest Lady Gaga stan. And
the greatest Star Is Born meme stan. Like, I don't even know about his Gaga fandom.
No, he is a huge Gaga fan, but this meme is taking him. He's galaxy braining. He's transcendental meditating. He is a god among a Star Is Born memesters. But all this memeing of the movie has made me wonder and kind of pull back, is this movie going to reach more people because of the memification of A Star Is Born? And then I start galaxy braining in terms of like what meme culture has done to the movies, and has a positive impact? Has it had a negative impact? Is it reductive of these movies? Is, I think that we've seen now that studios like A24 have Giphy pages, now that trailers seem clearly edited for moments to be ripped out and thrown on Tumblr to be gifted and memed. For Marvel to be able to carefully put the most ambitious crossover event of all time. I don't know if they knowingly thought that that would become memeified, but it, you know, dominated a summer, not even a summer, like a 3-week lead up to Avengers Infinity War, a movie that did not need the publicity or that meme. And Thanos became his own thing in the entire summer, was dominated by Thanos memes. I don't know what memes are doing to movie culture.
Our brains.
Something. Oh. And we're our brains. But I want to put it out to you guys, what impact are memes having on the way we're watching, or the way we're gearing up to watch, even? I mean,
memes in the simplest form just tell me when something resonates. Like when The Sunken Place becomes a meme that repeats itself over and over, you're like, okay, it's not just people who I know who are seeing Get Out and care about it, and it's not just that like people saw it and forget about it, that it's sunk into their brains. And I hadn't seen Infinity War when the Thanos meme started, but I was like, oh, so this isn't just like a regular Marvel movie where everyone dutifully goes. This is something that people actually care about. It's like the most obvious form of engaging with a movie, and you see why studios like A24 want to have the Giphy pages. Like, it's a dream for people to give you that kind of feedback about your movie and what they care about in it.
Sunken Place is interesting because it obviously has social resonance. It's a way to distill all of what's on Get Out's mind into a single image that can be repurposed and reused. It can be a greater part of the conversation by being packaged in that.
And it can be really funny, depending on how you use it.
Well, it's
right. And it helps. I mean, it always has to be funny. I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of a meme that caught on.
Well, most of yours.
Burn.
Burn. Shaboom! Ka-chow, as the Cars Owen Wilson
character would
say.
As David used to say.
Oh, right.
Indeed. And also, how dare you? Him. Also, as false as the person who said that I talk about going to Columbia, an Ivy League school, two times in the review section.
In this episode.
And now you talk about it again.
My Lady Bird meme is my greatest work, and how dare you impugn it. But they do have to be funny to have any sort of cultural penetration, but I think that what Katie is saying is absolutely right, that it is, especially in an age where it's hard to quantify how things do. We have the box office for things like Avengers, but you know, with everything that's hidden behind streaming and Netflix, and now, you know, memes are a way of sort of quantifying interest beyond tracking numbers to see how Star Is Born is going to do opening weekend. We can already tell just by, you know, anecdotal evidence, empirical evidence, that it has a sort of cultural penetration that's going to make it do well. I can already picture the Lady Gaga episode of SNL where they do a parody of the trailer of some kind. I mean, like, all this stuff already seems like it's in motion, even though the movie as a cultural object doesn't really exist yet.
You see that as a positive. From someone who has definitely spent time on this podcast, we all have, discussing like the trailer for the trailer and how that's kind of a devastating distillation of these movies. It's like, get on with it. We're done with anticipation culture.
I don't know.
How is the memification a month out when as soon as a trailer begins?
Well, it's
healthier
rare
for
the memification to be early like this. Like, most of the other examples we're talking about have come after a movie has opened.
Yeah. And I also don't feel like, well, I mean, more and more, I feel like that's not the case. And it can definitely go against a movie. I mean, there's a bit of ironic detachment to how we talk about A Star Is Born, but I think the memification of Venom, which wasn't nearly as intense as the memification of
Star Is Born. Well, if you go on Tumblr, you are wrong about that.
Oh, really?
If you go on Tumblr, that Venom tongue is everywhere, and it was for many years, but Jesus Christ, that shot of him with the tongue is highly sexualized meme.
Ew!
So, and that movie is actually tracking to open well, but it's not I don't know if those meetings are necessarily in the spirit of, like, sharing positivity and love for that movie. But I also think that to a certain degree, the memes, while a symbol of how much a movie is penetrating, because memes depend on their ubiquity, they depend on everyone speaking the same language, a meme doesn't have any value if it's not something that other people don't understand. I think that they are sort of a language around which we use to talk about the culture and to talk about even other things. I mean, it's like a framework or an alphabet that we can plug other things into. So you have Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga saying, like, hey, what? I just want to get another look at you. And then that just becomes like, we get the rhythm and the patter of that joke. We get the flow of it, and then we can plug in anything else we want to. And it doesn't necessarily, we all know what it comes back to. We all know that it's A Star Is Born, but it doesn't necessarily have to serve as like a conscious advertisement for that. Every time you use the meme, you're not saying to someone, hey, you should go see A Star Is Born, even if that's what WB is hoping the underlying message is. So right. I do think they're sort of like independent.
And the thing that matters about that meme, and I think most of the other ones, is that they're from you genuinely liking something. Like, there are memes of, like, you know, Nicolas Cage and the Wicker Man saying, like, not the bees, but that has a shelf life, and that's something that kind of becomes distinct from the movie that you're talking about. But when it's this language where you're using it to talk about something that you like, and with A Star Is Born, it's either something you're anticipating, or, like we said last week, David, like, you were trading Star Is Born memes, and you really liked the movie. Like, it's not coming from a desire to dislike it.
No.
The memes are better. This is an interesting example because the memes are better than the movie. It doesn't matter to the accountants at Warner Brothers when this movie rakes in money and nominations hand over fist. But, which I think
we don't care about them. We care about the cultural aspects or the cultural legacy of these movies, or at least the critical takes on them.
There is truth to what Katie's saying, especially to go back to the greatest of all movie memes in history, My Lady Bird meme. That is coming from a deep place of love. I love that movie. I love how that one scene that I keep quoting in that movie about...
But like, you're doing that to it, but that's because you had seen the movie and then you had processed the meme
for people. I didn't start that meme until like March. So everyone had seen the movie at that point. Okay. But
that's the thing. Like, the memes that come out before are different than the memes that come out after. Like, I was just listening to a fabulous episode of the Ringer's podcast, The Rewatchables. They were talking about Mad Max Fury Road. And Mad Max, I mean, not a lot of people saw that movie, but I think a lot of people have seen that movie. And part of it is because it's just become a fantastic... There's so many parts of it have been memeified, especially the that's bait in the Trump era, I feel like, is a very popular meme and has brought a lot of people to that movie. It's a very successful memification to viewership. But for A Star Is Born and some of these other ones, like, I even think about Captain Marvel and seeing this, I'm seeing this punching meme. And if you haven't watched this trailer, 4 million people have already, but Captain Marvel punches an old lady in the face. That's a fantastic visual, and you do have to wonder if they know exactly what they're doing, putting that in there in
they
a certain like 2 seconds.
Yeah, exactly,
but if they did, isn't it like kind of obscured? Like, you, like, I don't know, the way they shoot it, it's not ideal for a memification
because you can't, you don't see it. Like,
that's why I have not seen this. Like, there were a lot of people talking about it, but I have not seen it blossom into what I would say is a meme,
a full blown.
Yeah, full-blown meme.
Three-panel meme.
And I think maybe, well, obviously memes and movies have very different artistic criteria and purposes. Maybe this is an indication that Captain Marvel was shot poorly. They didn't capture the emotion and the visual information they needed. Maybe I should write off Captain Marvel right now based on the fact that I couldn't make a meme out of a scene where she punches a woman in the face. What is happening to filmmakers today?
Were there memes from the Black Panther trailer? I feel like there were, but I can't think of them now.
I don't remember that. I don't either.
No, I don't. I feel like Black Panther transcended memes. It was.
I think you're right about that. I think that was a cohesive trailer that was kind of it could not be shattered. It landed with an amazing impact. It just no one wanted to break it up. Everyone wanted to keep rewatching it and rewatching it. Maybe that's a testament to the eventual film.
I've been waiting for there to be a meme of everyone like shrugging their shoulders and when they're at the waterfall and doing kind of the ritual fighting because like everyone's kind of dancing for a second. Anyway, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
I mean, it may have happened now. Have you done the digging?
No, God, I'm not on Tumblr. I have no idea. So if you can find me this GIF, find it. for me.
Someone is going to fight us. But I'll give you another example since we're kind of like dancing around. I mean, my biggest fear, I haven't seen A Star Is Born yet, unlike the two of you. And my biggest fear is that these memes dilute, and I feel the effect of it myself. I don't understand what people are talking about. And I worry that when I see the film eventually, it will have just been memeified. I'll laugh at the enjoyment that I have of this charade, of this circus that people are creating out of memes, will be more entertaining than the actual film that I could have enjoyed myself. And it feels damaging.
That's A Star Is Born's fault. I think it is possible that you may have enjoyed the memes more than the movie, but that's because the movie is 9 hours long and the second act is interminable.
Man, I swear to God, you liked A Star Is Born a week ago.
He liked it on Twitter after TIFF. You got to get the RTs. You know, he's thirsty.
I like Star Is Born. I'm seeing it again on opening weekend with Elisa, and I'll have a more coherent opinion after that. But I love the first half of that movie. Like, it's wonderful. And I just, like, I was pretty turned off in the second half. And over time, my feelings about that have soured, especially because I feel like I've been able to concentrate, maybe to what Patches is saying, my love for the entire first half of that movie into a single round of memes. Right, into a single GIF or set of images or a couple notes from The Shallow.
I'll give you another example. I think that the It movie from last year was super hyped, but a lot of the hype came from seeing the Skarsgård. Is it Bill Skarsgård who's in It?
Oh, I thought you were saying like the It movie, and I was like, Get Out?
Great. The Someone, It movie of 20? No. Yeah.
It's not like the It Girl. The It Girl in
here.
The clown context would be very interesting.
No, I'm talking about IT, Stephen King's It, full title, and Bill Skarsgård in this makeup, and everyone just memeing the hell out of this image, because it's a perfect image. The costume is fantastic. You want to see him creeping on all sorts of people in all sorts of ways. It's just like, as soon as you put that photo out there, as soon as you put that moment, this is what so many movies and TV shows do run into. Like, you want to put your best foot forward. I even think about, like, this Joker photo, more clowns. I guess clown images really stick, but this photo of Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker that's floating around the internet now, like, it's just too powerful. You can do everything with it, and with Photoshop or with, I don't know, MS Paint, anyone can do anything. And it just completely undermines whatever you're trying to do with that image in the context of your film. But I don't know if the internet allow, like, what movie has been preserved to that end? I don't know. What powerful images?
What do you mean?
What powerful images have made it to the film successfully where you get to bask in them? What?
I mean,
can you think of anything that you've seen in a movie in the last year or two that you made it all the way to the movie to see?
Wait. Like, that weren't released ahead of time, or that, like...
Yeah, I guess that's
but
what I'm getting at.
I don't know if the emphasis on when the movie comes out is so important, because as we said, you know, memes don't mean anything unless everyone can share in them. And so I think because the focus was so much on the Star Is Born trailer rather than the movie, critics who were leading the charge on these memes and had incidentally seen the movie felt comfortable sharing them, and they were able to explode just outside of our own little Twitter bubble. But I don't think that if I went and saw, you know, Suspiria a couple months ago, which I did, humble brag, and sorry, I've been listening to too much Blank Check. There's no point if there's a scene from that I think would catch on and be funny for us all to talk about for me to mention. And at worst, it's a spoiler, and the best case scenario, it's something like three other people get. So it's no point.
Well, and they, like, you're thinking about, speaking of It movies from last year, like, when The Greatest Showman, before it came out, like, people weren't really, like, hyped for it. There wasn't, like, a marketing campaign that people were swapping around, and that movie grew and grew and grew, and has been heavily memed and, like, covered on YouTube and all this other stuff. So there's a culture that grows around it.
Has it been memed? I mean, I don't know. I assume it's been loved ironically.
I don't know. Like, if you go on YouTube, like, there are so many high school kids, doing covers of The Greatest Showman.
But is that
That's
a meme?
True. It became an ice bucket challenge more than
I don't know
like
if
a
that,
graphic
does that count
meme.
As a meme.
Like, I think I, that does I, count as a meme.
I don't. I honestly don't know. I have watched two seasons of American Vandal. I still have no fucking idea what a meme is. But I sing that. You know, I sing the songs from that musical at karaoke. I sing them in the shower.
Are you the worst friend at karaoke? You sound like a horrible friend. Why would you sing those songs?
I did. To the other side. in it as a duet. It was beautiful.
Do it now.
But I don't know if that was mean so much as it was like, I don't know. Like we were talking about that movie a lot in the same way, in the same tone that we talk about memes and we share memes, but I don't know if it necessarily was a meme itself.
Anyway, I feel like, Patches, you are trying to maybe argue that these memes are bad for the movies themselves. Is that, I mean, are you unclear on it, or do you definitely think that they're bad?
No, I think I'm split. I feel like I can make an argument for how they, I think they can erode a movie. That's my fear, that the memification becomes more fun and therefore it creates a barrier between us and the movie that we eventually
want to
watch.
Can you think of an example?
Well, I'm worried that A Star Is Born is coming up. I'm trying to think of other examples here. But the flip side is I also think they can get people to see movies. I feel like in this day and age, a movie needs to breach the Tumblr crowd, the like 25 and under crowd, by becoming a meme that people have to decipher and kind of like backtrack and figure out what is this movie. And I feel like a lot of indie horror has seen that success, that a lot of
like how the Babadook became a meme,
like the Babadook, or I think It Follows has had images that
the
people
Babadook
have
became a gay icon. Different.
I think it was memified and became a gay icon. I think if you really trace the internet line on that, there you could qualify it as a meme. But so it obviously has it. It's a way of stumping for the movies that we care about. So I'm split. I just don't know what impact they're really having, and I don't know if there's a way to quantify it. I was having a conversation with someone about, like, is there a way that we could figure out eventually how the impact these are really having on people? But it almost feels like billboard advertising. Do you know if a giant billboard in Times Square is getting someone to see A Star Is Born, if invasive advertising
they don't
like
even
that
know
is working? Yeah, no one knows. So does a meme
that's
have that power?
For you.
And that's how, yeah, so maybe this is, you know, we will talk about this hopefully next week, Maniac on Netflix, but maybe memes are just like, they have these futuristic ads in Maniac that are just people talking to you.
Ad buddies.
Yeah, ad buddies, where they're just like, I think you buy, instead of buying for something, you can opt in to have a person just sit there and talk
to you.
Yeah,
it's like a
and
like a
kind
freemium,
of ruin your life.
It's experience. Like a freemium app.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually somebody figures out that you can essentially get like anything for free if you're willing to watch enough ads.
Yeah.
And you can just like, you know, go to California with an ad buddy and you'll have to watch like 100,000 ads.
Everyone should watch Maniac before next episode, because we're definitely going to talk about it. It's so pleasurable, all these things. But yeah, my question is, like, have we created, I guess we're just advertising now. All of us are in the ad business. Anyone memeing is just creating more advertising, and we are so dulled down by the advertising in our life already that we accept it and we're like hungry for more.
Yeah, but
ads.
It's also, I mean,
I'm really galaxy braining right now.
There's nothing untrue to what you said, but at the same time, I think that the power, the tone of how we use these things to communicate is in our hands. We live this monoculture now where everything is going to be, you know, in service to some sort of like greater cultural content. But there's also the memes are sometimes an end unto themselves. So, like, yes, we're speaking the language that is owned by someone else, and they might profit off of if you decide to, if it inspires you to go to the movies and see what the meme was all about. But the meme is also an end unto itself. And I guarantee you that a lot of the people who are sharing A Star Is Born memes are going to torrent the movie, maybe. Or maybe just never see it at all, let alone go see it in theater. So, yeah, I don't know.
You know what I'd like to hear as we wrap this segment up? I'm curious if our listeners, if they are aware of these memes at all, or if there are a totally different set of memes that we're not talking about, because I think we have some idea of what escapes our film Twitter world, but not a ton, like, you know, us wondering if Greatest Showman memes exist. When I just sent you guys some fan art of Spider-Man listening to This Is Me that I found on Tumblr, just to prove that that can't exist.
Yeah, no, during the Kavanaugh hearings last week, somebody referenced my Lady Bird memes, so I'm pretty sure that they're you're getting out there.
Is that a good thing?
Did Kavanaugh reference them himself?
No, I was really like, this is unclean. But someone was just like, I just want you to be the best version of yourself that you can be. And everyone was like, it's too late. But
wow.
Anyway, I would like to hear from people what movie memes that you are seeing, whether they be Stars Born or other things.
And where you're seeing them.
And where you're seeing them, yeah. Because we obviously, as people who don't know what anything means, because we're old, we need help.
And if you're not on Twitter, put them on our fightinginthewarroom.com, because I know that people are not all on Twitter, but they all have the internet, I think.
If you're listening to this podcast, you probably have the internet.
Now let me say something that's a meme. That's bait.
What did you say?
That's bait. That's bait. That's bait. That's bait.
Fish are friends.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week, hopefully, with everybody back in one place. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, even old ones that aren't on iTunes. I'm feeling extra adventurous. You can share them with your friends, or you can leave. We're requesting. We want to know movie memes that you hear about and where you hear about them. And you should put them on our website, fightinginthewarroom.com. I'll learn.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find me writing on IndieWire. You can find me writing on IndieWire about Blake Lively at length and about why Simple Favor is so good, and talking all about Preserve and quoting Vanity Fair. Hey,
in their you wrote a lot about Preserve in its heyday.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I read some of it. It was good stuff. You can find all of us together on Facebook, Fighting in the War Room.
I'm not Dave Gonzalez, but I'm Katie Rich. If Dave were here, he would tell you to listen to Storm of Spoilers. Anyway, you can find me at vanityfair.com. This week I talked to Rebecca Root, who has a small but pivotal role in The Sisters Brothers, which we talked about a little bit last week. She's a trans actress who is just really interesting, and her part is interesting. So if you see The Sisters Brothers, go read that. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter, where we want to hear about you and memes, at FITWR. And you can also answer this week's lightning round question. Patches, do you want to tell us what it was?
Yes, in honor of Free Solo, what's the most genuinely scary thing you've ever seen in a documentary?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.